All right, ready to dive into another fascinating case?
Absolutely. Always up for a good legal deep dive.
Perfect. Today we're tackling Oliphant v. Suquamish Indian Tribe. It's a landmark Supreme Court case from 1978. This one really shook things up in the world of tribal law, especially when we're talking about tribal sovereignty.
That's a big one, for sure.
And we've got a lot to unpack, from case briefs and court opinions to even some in-depth analysis.
Yeah, it's definitely a case with some nuances, and it gets right to the heart of that tricky relationship between tribal law and federal law. You know, the whole concept of inherent sovereignty, it's a fascinating legal concept.
Right, like tribes have that inherent right to govern themselves.
Exactly. But the question this case brought up was, how far can that sovereignty actually extend, especially when non-tribal members are involved? That's where things get a little messy.
Okay, so let's paint a picture for our listeners.
Yeah.
Picture this. We're on the Port Madison Indian Reservation in Washington State.
Got
two non-Native American guys, Mark David Oliphant and Daniel Bellegarde, find themselves arrested by tribal authorities. Now, the details of their arrests aren't super important for our deep dive today.
Right.
But what I ask important is that both of them challenge the tribe's very authority to even prosecute them. That's the heart of the matter.
Absolutely. And that's a pretty bold move. You see, they argued that tribal courts shouldn't have the power to prosecute non-Indians for crimes that happen on reservation land. Their reasoning. This power, they said, was never explicitly granted by Congress or through treaties.
So they're essentially saying, hey, you can govern yourselves, but only up to a certain point.
Yeah, essentially. And this was a direct challenge to the Suquamish tribe's own law and order code, which, you guessed it, they'd established based on their inherent sovereignty.
Okay, so it's a head-to-head. You have the Suquamish tribe saying, hey, we have the right to govern our land. And then Oliphant and Bellegarde saying, hold on, not when it comes to us.
Precisely. It's this clash of legal principles. And honestly, no surprise, it ended up at the Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, that seems like a pretty big deal.
It was a big deal. And that's where things get even more interesting, especially for anyone who wants to really understand how tribal law works. The Supreme Court was basically tasked with deciding once and for all, can tribal courts actually prosecute non-Indians for crimes that happen on their land? And if not, what does that mean for tribal sovereignty?
So lay it on me. What did the Supreme Court decide? Don't leave us hanging.
All right. No more suspense. In a 6-3 decision, they actually sided with Oliphant and Bellegarde. Justice Rehnquist wrote the majority opinion, and his reasoning is super important if you want to understand the long-term effects of this case.
All right, so break it down for us. What was Rehnquist's reasoning?
Well, one of his main points was that historically there wasn't really any clear precedent for tribes having this kind of broad jurisdiction over non-Indians. He argued that if you look at how Congress has acted, it's almost as if they've always operated under the assumption that tribes didn't have this power.
So he's basically saying that past actions, or in this case, lack of actions by Congress, suggest that tribes weren't meant to have this kind of authority.
You got it. And then he added another layer, this really important concept. He said that tribes, while having inherent sovereignty, are still considered, and this is the key term, domestic dependent nations. That basically means that at the end of the day, they're still subject to the authority of the U.S. government.
So even though tribes have this inherent right to govern themselves, they're still ultimately under the umbrella of the U.S. government.
Exactly. And according to Rehnquist, that puts some limitations on their inherent sovereignty.
Wow, that seems like it could create some real tension.
Oh, absolutely. That whole concept of domestic dependent nations has been debated like crazy ever since. Some people argue it's a necessary framework for the relationship between the federal government and tribes. Others see it as a big limitation on tribal self-governance.
Yeah, I can see how that would be a tricky concept to navigate. Definitely adds another layer of complexity. But before we get too deep into that, I do want to hear a bit more about the dissenting opinion in this case. You mentioned it was a 6-3 decision.
Right.
So clearly, not everyone on the court was on board with Rehnquist's thinking.
You're right. Justice Marshall wrote a pretty strong dissent, arguing that tribal authority should be interpreted more broadly. He felt that the majority opinion was basically chipping away at tribal sovereignty. And he thought it didn't really take into account the unique historical and political relationship between tribes and the federal government, which is a valid point.
Yeah, it's important to remember, it wasn't a unanimous decision. There were strong arguments on both sides. But even with the dissent, that majority opinion in Oliphant, it really did set a precedent that has shaped how tribal law works ever since.
It definitely did. And that's where we start to see the real lasting consequences of this case, both good and bad, which we can dig into as we keep going with our dick dive. So, you know, we've talked about how the Oliphant decision really kind of messed things up for tribal justice systems.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me, it's not just some legal debate. You know, it actually has real consequences for people in these communities.
Right. It's not just some abstract legal theory. It's about whether tribes can actually protect their people, enforce their own laws on their land. Makes you wonder what actually happened on reservations after this Oliphant decision came down.
Well, imagine this, right? You're a tribal leader. You're trying to keep things safe and orderly on your reservation. You've got tribal police, tribal courts, the whole system set up.
Makes sense.
Then, boom, the Supreme Court says, oh, by the way, you can't prosecute a big chunk of the people living on your land, the non-Indians.
Wow, that seems like it would cause some problems, especially if there's, you know, tension or conflict between tribal members and non-tribal residents.
Yep. Exactly. It created the situation where tribes often had to go to federal or state authorities to prosecute non-Indian offenders.
Even for crimes on their own land.
Even for crimes committed against tribal members on their own land. Think about that.
It just seems backwards. You'd think the tribe would have the main authority to handle crime on their own reservation.
You'd think so, right. But that's the reality after Oliphant. And that dependence on outside law enforcement, it often led to problems.
Like what kinds of problems?
Okay, think about it this way. Say a non-Indian assaults a Native American on tribal land.
Okay.
The tribal police, they might arrest the person, but then what? They can't prosecute. They have to hand it over to federal or state authorities.
Yeah.
Those authorities, well, they might not see it as a priority.
Ah, I see.
Or worse, you know, they might be biased against the tribal victim.
So even though the crime happened on tribal land, the victim was a tribal member, the tribe itself can't really do anything about it.
Yeah, that was the reality a lot of times. It left tribal members feeling vulnerable, unprotected on their own land. It's like, you know, having your hands tied when you're trying to keep your community safe.
It's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah.
Unjust, really. It sounds like Oliphant created this huge gap in law enforcement on reservations.
But you got it. That's exactly why this case caused such a big debate. Tribal leaders, legal experts, activists, they've been fighting against this decision for years.
Saying that it undermines tribal sovereignty, puts communities at risk.
Right. And remember, this isn't ancient history. The impact of Oliphant is still felt today.
So it's not like people just accepted it and moved on.
No way. There have been attempts to address this. One of the biggest is the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act of 2013. That's VAWA.
VAWA. Okay. I've heard of it, but to be honest, I don't really know much about it. How does it connect to Oliphant?
So, VAWA, it was a big deal because it actually kind of chipped away at the limits set by Oliphant, in certain situations at least. It recognized that tribes do have jurisdiction over non-Indians when it comes to domestic violence against Native Americans on tribal lands.
So Congress basically said, okay, in these specific cases, tribes can prosecute non-Indians.
Exactly. It was a win for tribal sovereignty and for protecting Native American women.
Sounds like a turning point.
You could say that, but it's important to remember it's a limited exception. The bigger issue of tribal jurisdiction over non-Indians in other types of crimes, that's still a huge debate.
So we're still dealing with the fallout from Oliphant. It feels like there's a long way to go to really achieve full tribal sovereignty, especially when it comes to criminal justice.
That's a great point. This wasn't just a legal case. It was about big ideas, sovereignty, justice, self-determination. It brought up some complicated questions about how tribes, states, and the federal government all relate to each other. And there aren't easy answers.
It's a lot to consider, for sure. And even though this case happened decades ago, it has effects that reach far beyond the legal world.
You're right. It's a good example of how a court decision can have real-world consequences. It affects real people and communities.
You know, it really makes you think about how much weight history carries, right? We're talking about a case from, what was it, 1978.
Mm-hmm.
But it still feels so relevant today.
It shows you how much legal precedents really shape our society. This wasn't just some court ruling, you know. It was a turning point that's still affecting how tribal nations and the U.S. government interact.
We've covered a lot in this deep dive. We started with those initial arrests that kind of kicked things off, then went into all the complexities of inherent sovereignty. And of course, the Supreme Court decision and all its lasting effects. But I'm curious, from all of this, what do you see as the biggest takeaway?
I think the most important thing is how this case shows us the ongoing struggle to find a balance. a balance between tribal sovereignty and how far federal power reaches. On one hand, you've got this inherent right of tribal nations to govern themselves. That right, it even predates the United States itself.
Right.
But then on the other hand, you have this reality that these nations exist within a larger federal system, and that's where all the questions of jurisdiction and authority pop up.
It's like trying to fit two puzzle pieces together that weren't made to fit, you know?
That's a great way to put it. And that's exactly what makes this issue so fascinating and so tough to figure out. Finding that sweet spot, that balance where tribal sovereignty and federal law both get the respect they deserve, well, it takes a lot of work. It takes dialogue, negotiation, and being willing to deal with some really tough questions.
But it's not just about finding a one-size-fits-all answer, right? It's more about keeping the conversation going, being open to change.
Exactly. And that's why these cases like Oliphant are so important for us to understand. They give us these really valuable insights. They show us the history, the legal details, the human impact of trying to find that balance.
This has definitely been an eye-opener for me. I'll admit, before we started this deep dive, I didn't really get how much I didn't know about tribal law and about all the challenges that tribal nations face.
You know, a lot of people think tribal law is somehow separate from the American legal system. But the truth is, it's all connected. If you want to really understand American law and justice, you have to understand that connection.
And I really hope our listeners take that away from this deep dive. Tribal law isn't just some side topic. It's a core part of our legal system, our shared history.
I agree completely. And as we keep learning and moving forward, I think it's crucial for us to come at these issues with empathy, trying to understand different points of view, and being ready to work towards solutions that honor both tribal sovereignty and the rights of everyone involved.
Well said. And on that note, I think it's time to wrap up our deep dive for today. But before we sign off, I want to leave our listeners with something to think about. We've talked about the laws, the politics, all that, but I think the human side of it is important too. Imagine living on a reservation and knowing that your tribe's power to protect you, to enforce the law, it's limited because of decisions made years ago. Decisions you had no say in. How would that feel? How would it change your view of justice, of belonging, of where you fit in the bigger picture? It's worth thinking about. It reminds us that these legal decisions, they're not just abstract ideas. They have real consequences that affect real people's lives.
That's a powerful way to end our deep dive. It brings us back to what really matters, the human stories, the experiences that often get lost in all legal and political back and forth.
Thanks for joining me on this journey. Until next time, deep divers, keep exploring, keep asking those tough questions, and keep learning.